Good morning, everyone. It's approximately 9 a.m. on Friday, November 2nd. This is the date and time set for the Utah State Tax Commission public meeting. I'm Commissioner Bruce Johnson. With me is Commissioner Mark Johnson, Commissioner Darcy Dixon Pignanelli, and Commissioner Michael Cragen. Also with us is Scott Smith, our Deputy Executive Director. At this point, I'll ask if there are any members of the public who would like to comment on any matters coming before the commission at this time. Seeing none, we'll go to item three on the agenda, which is to consider approving the open and closed commission meeting minutes of Thursday, October 11th and Thursday, October 25th, 2012. Or any discussion on the minutes? If not, I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
It's Commissioner Dixon, I move approval of the minute.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those both sets of minutes are approved. At this point, the next item on our agenda is to consider settlements in various cases that are set forth on the agenda. I think at this point we probably need to go into a closed session to consult with our attorneys and get their advice on these settlements. We do have Mr. Morris Jackson who's with us and will be interested in being here for the public portion when we take action on those items. So Mr. McCary, you anticipate that might be 15 or 20 minutes or so?
I don't think it'll, our discussion should take very long.
Well, Morris, if you'd like to have a healthy brunch in our cafeteria there, we'll make sure that we come and get you when we go back into public session. Thank you for your attendance.
I'd move that we go into closed session to discuss pending or reasonably imminent litigation.
Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, I'll. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. You okay? Good morning, everyone. We are back in open session. This is Friday, November 2nd, the Tax Commission, continuation of the Tax Commission open meeting. We have been in closed session to discuss certain pending litigation matters. We are now on item four of the agenda, which is to consider settlement of the following cases, AT&T, Kern River, Northwest Pipeline, Pacific Corp, Questar Gas, Questar Transportation, and Questar Pipeline, and the identifying docket numbers are on our agenda. Is there a motion?
I'd move that we approve the settlement agreements as they've been presented to us and authorize our attorney's signature on our behalf.
Is there any discussion of that motion? We have Mr. Morris Jackson with us, who is a representative, although not the legal representative, but nevertheless a representative of Questar Gas, Questar Transportation, I think, and Questar Pipeline. Morris, do you have any comments you'd like to make at this point?
I'd just say.
Please come up to the microphone so we can get you on the recording.
My name is Morris Jackson. I'm the general manager of Questar Corporation Tax Department and represent each of the Questar companies. We are very pleased to have this finally settled after these many years and the process that has gone through. And, we're in support of a favorable recommendation on these matters.
Well, we appreciate. Seriously appreciate our taxpayers, and you know we're happy to So I'm anticipating what the vote will be, but it's I guess we appreciate the working relationship we've had with Questar over the years, and confident that will continue, and hope that you always feel able to address us and bring matters to our attention that are of concern to your companies.
Well, on our side, I will also say we very much appreciate the openness of our tax commission and the willingness for us to be able to sit down and discuss issues, and that we have a good working relationship, and we plan on keeping it that way.
Thank you. There's a motion before us to approve these settlements. I'll call the question. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That motion is approved. Thank you very much. Thank you, Morris. Item number 5 on our agenda is to consider settlement of River Gas Corporation versus the Utah State Tax Commission. This is a district court case. I'd entertain a motion to approve that settlement.
It's Commissioner Dixon, I move settlement of the River Gas Corporation versus the Utah State Tax Commission, now pending in the district court. And as my fellow commissioner said on the previous motion, to authorize our legal counsel to sign that, or our executive director.
Very good. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 That motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Mr. McCary, and express our thanks also to Mr. Snelson.
Thank you.
And it's good to get all those issues resolved.
Just want to know what you're going to do about your spare time.
Until?
Santa.
All right, we're back on the record. It's still Friday morning, November 2nd. This is the Tax Commission open meeting. We are now moving to item 6 on our agenda, which is a presentation on confidentiality of property tax information. And we have Denny Lytle, who's our Property Tax Division Director, with us, and Craig Jolly, who's the Assistant Division Director, who will be making the presentation. Mr. Jolly, welcome.
Ready?
Go for it. That's the best I can do in terms of an introduction. I mean, if you were expecting more.
Did you want applause?
The applause.
It's probably good that you don't know anything about me, so. All right, well, I appreciate this opportunity. This presentation was made to the county assessors in June. This is an age-old, well, not age-old, but it's for the last several years, this question has plagued assessors and their staff, anybody in the property tax arena, and I'm sure that you as ALJs and the commissioners, you get lots of questions about this topic. So. We endeavored to try to survey the law and get as many opinions and information about this. I'm not an attorney, so my job was to survey all of the different laws that I could become aware of, and then talk to people, have conversations with. Commissioner Cragen was one that assisted me. I talked with Dolores Furness regarding grandma and other issues. Here at the Tax Commission, I talked with someone at the AG's office. Was it Barbara? Anyway, somebody that's a specialist up there. And I've come to the conclusion that it requires sort of a community effort to understand this complex issue. And so I welcome any comments and feedback. Everything that I'm presenting today is still in draft form and with updates periodically as I get feedback, and particularly finding out if something doesn't quite cut it. So to start out with, I have to learn how to use this first. Can I use arrows? The second page is a table that simply gives an overview of the different laws that impact us regarding confidentiality. There are five major categories of law, and so this just gives an overview. Of course, the first column is the commercial statutes that govern commercial confidentiality, the grandma statutes, the Government Records Access Management Act. The third column is the multiple listing service contract, and that specifically is a contract that the counties and the tax commission have made with the Wasatch Front Regional Multiple Listing Service regarding use of their data. And the fourth category is USPAP, that's the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, which all appraisers in the state of Utah are subject to. I'm curious, is how many in here are licensed appraisers? I know Denny is. So,
Commissioner Johnson.
And he's, for most of what he does, he's exempt from it anyway, so. But that's a topic that the assessors are interested in as well. And finally, the laws that govern public information, specifically indicating what is or not public. And also, so this is just an overview. I've got the typical kinds of information listed in the first row that those laws govern. The second row, the steward is the party that's accountable for that information, accountable to the law. And then the source of the information, and then the permitted use or the recipients that are allowed to receive this or that we're permitted to give this information to. And then finally, any conditions pertaining to that law. So I'll skip over that and let's get into the details. Starting with the commercial information, the statute is 59-1-404. And this is a very simplified flow chart to just help the county assessors have an understanding of where to go in pursuing what decisions to make about giving information or not. The top has the different recipients, and then the information flow below that, and then finally the action that would be required. Taxpayers can receive their own data from us without any consequence. The taxpayer's official representative, the tax commission and the counties can share this commercial data back and forth. The next group over, third parties or the public, of course, follow the flow chart only if it's public information. And finally, the group that is most of most interest to you and to the assessors is fee appraisers, private appraisers, and hearings. And if you follow the flow chart down there, of course, if the information is designated public or not designated as commercial information, then it may be simply shared. But if it is designated as confidential in this statute, then you have one or two paths. If it's independently verified, I guess I better update that. If the information is independently verified, then you simply have the obligation of having the recipient sign a confidentiality agreement, and then you may share it. However, if it's not information that you have independently verified, then you have to go to a third, if it's from a third party source, then you have to go to that source to get permission to share that information. And if you don't obtain the permission, or if you don't obtain the confidentiality agreement signed by the recipient, then you redact the information that's commercial. On the next page, the data items that are listed in the statute, 59-1-404 paragraph 3 specifically states which property or which information is public. The assessed value, tax rate, legal description, street address, parcel number, physical characteristics, size of land improvements, name and mailing address of taxpayer, and the property tax. And most of this information is available in the public property records that the assessor has on file. But under property tax, it includes assessed, due, collected, abated, and deferred taxes, interest, penalties, exempt status, bankruptcy filing, action or proceeding, and tax sale information. All of that is specifically listed in the statute as public. It also makes a generic statement that single-family residential info is not considered confidential. And so we've sort of raised the question, does that include residential sales? Even if it's a residential sale, since there is financing involved and various other things, does that mean it's commercial information? But we're making the assumption that residential sales are excluded based on this statement. Yeah.
One interesting tidbit for the commission maybe is that while assessed value is normally public, we treat the system value for centrally assessed companies as confidential. The Utah value as public, but the system value is confidential.
Okay. The information that's listed as confidential, the term that's defined in statute is commercial information, and we'll get into more detail on that. Other information that's confidential, and I'm kind of overlapping various confidentiality laws throughout this presentation, but real property transfer surveys are confidential, but not because of this statute, because of grandma. Sales info that we have in RatioLink. RatioLink is the database that the property tax division uses to house our sales information that we use for the sale ratio study. Sales info from the multiple listing service is also confidential for other reasons based on another law. On the next page, the definition of commercial Craig, information.
Craig?
Yes.
I mean, how does that actually work then in practice? If an assessor gets a sale from the multiple listing service, I mean, they'll want to use that in a hearing.
Right.
Right? Can they do that if it's confidential?
They by contract,
are you going to get into that later. Okay. I'll wait.
Okay. It is specified in the contract. So, the definition of commercial information is first anything of a commercial nature, information of a commercial nature. Two, if it's obtained, that is obtained from a taxpayer. Now, this is one long statement in the code, but I've broken it down because there's a question, which taxpayer? Is it the taxpayer that is the subject of, for example, an appeal? Is it the subject property's owner? Or could it also include property information derived from comparable sales? And we've come to the conclusion that it's any information, regardless of who the taxpayer is, because of it ultimately came from a taxpayer one way or another. So we'll just interpret it that way unless somebody disagrees. And so far, nobody has some. Third, it's regarding the taxpayer's property. And fourth, or derived therefrom. And derived from obviously would mean work files, any analysis that exposes the original information in any form other than a very generic, non-identifying way. It does not include information intended for public use. And so down below, I've got some examples of specific information that would fall in this definition. Sales price, commercial only, financing terms of commercial property, cap rates, income and expense, and anything that is not specifically listed as public. The permissible recipients of this information, based on the statute, are first of all the taxpayer or the authorized representative. And you'll note in parentheses I've got the particular paragraph in the statute in the section that applies to this. Secondly, a purchaser of the property. And I'd ask you, do you think that means a potential purchaser? If someone's interested in buying a property, are they permitted to receive this information? OK. Okay, I'll answer.
I don't think they've, not from us.
Yeah.
The seller, they might be entitled to demand it before I buy.
Actually reading, I guess it's more the way I printed the bullet than the statute does specify a little bit better. It sounds more like past tense. A property taxpayer that purchases property from another property taxpayer, I guess we can assume that the transaction has to have occurred for that to be the case. Third, the tax commission or the county can receive that information. However, interestingly enough, cities and towns are not permitted to receive that information, although they are accountable if they have it. So that's kind of an interesting twist. I'm not sure if that was intended or just the way it shook out after they wrote the statute. Fourth, can be used in the publication of statistics without any identity attached. Fifth, it can be shared with an appraiser, meaning a private fee-type appraiser, subject to certain restrictions. And sixth, it can be shared in legal action or proceedings, also subject to restrictions. So if this commercial information is shared with an appraiser, what can be shared? There are four, I call it the four big items. Four things can be shared with a fee appraiser: the sale price, the financing terms, the cap rates on locally assessed property, not centrally, and fourth, income and expense information on locally assessed property. Those are the only four things. The stuff that would have to be redacted includes all other commercial information. And does anybody have an idea of what kinds of other commercial information there would be other than those four? What do you deal with in your hearings? What information is presented that goes beyond those four items? This is for my benefit.
Contamination.
Contamination of property documents that include that. Okay. What about lease contracts? Did people present those as evidence?
How isn't that expense information? If it's
so that's a good question.
Income information, if it's the lessee, it's
would the lease contract include more than income and expense information? It may. I guess that's something subject to an attorney's interpretation or a judge's interpretation, but I would assume that to be safe, if you present specifically the expenses and specifically the income, but not a lease contract, you're fine, but inside a lease contract, there might be additional information that would be confidential. Closing statements often include information other than simply the sale price. Rent rolls, that could be considered just part of the income information. However, there might be identity information or other information in the rent roll that goes beyond simple income. So I guess that's subject to some interpretation there. In turn, once an appraiser receives this information, down at the bottom, that appraiser may share the information with the tax commission, with the county, or with the city or town. So again, cities and towns can receive the information from a private fee appraiser, but they can't receive it from the tax commission or the counties, which is kind of interesting the way the law is worded. Secondly, they can share it with another appraiser. Third, they can use it in an appraisal if they remove the identity, redact the identity information. Or same thing applies to a consultation service if the identity is removed. Now, these four items would be included in a confidentiality statement for anyone that's sharing information with a private fee appraiser. It would be important to include those statements. Now, a question was asked by assessors whether they can allow, I think it is the practice of some assessors, to allow some of the fee appraisers that they're acquainted with to have free access to their files and their drawers. Based on this, I would say that they shouldn't be granting that, because only those four items are allowed to be shared with appraisers, and they don't want them to get other information. Next page, commercial information that would be shared, or actually the statute says shall disclose in a legal action or proceeding. It's not permissible, but it's sort of a requirement. It may be shared in accordance with judicial order to on behalf of any party if the information is directly involved. Now, I have a question where there's a scenario that occurred, and I'd welcome your opinion on this, but an assessor failed to provide a certain piece of information prior to the 10-day limit, deadline, and during the hearing tried to present some information. The appellant objected, and the objection was sustained, and so the information was not presented. After the hearing, the appellant contacted the assessor and wanted access to this information. And the assessor, based on this law, said it's not directly involved in the hearing and so refused to give it. Do you believe that was appropriate? Yeah? I got one yes.
And it wasn't the party's information, it was other information, not...
I believe it was comparable sales information. So you agree if it were information regarding the subject property, then you think it would be directly involved, even if it were not admitted as evidence?
Well, I think it would be covered by a different section. If it's their, if it's information related to their property, I think they're entitled to it way back up here.
Did the assessors use that information in the valuation process?
No, I think it was intended to use to defend the value in the hearing. In the appeal.
Did not use it in development of the initial value?
I don't believe so. Yeah. The third thing, the information shall be shared in preparation for an action or proceeding, and this was a question that some of the assessors had. Is it okay to share the information prior to the hearing? And that answers that question. Fourth, they shall disclose information from the following sources, if relevant, if they are not a party. That means these four are not parties to the hearing. Information derived from a real estate agent, an appraiser, a property manager, or another taxpayer. Now, if this information is shared in relation to an action or proceeding, what is the form of confidentiality agreement, or how do they ensure confidentiality? Number one, in case of Board of Equalization, the law says that they take action to ensure non-disclosure. We've encouraged them to create their own confidentiality agreement in order to satisfy that and to have everyone sign those before they go into a commercial appeal. Number two, the Tax Commission enters a protective order or makes rules. And I've been informed by Commissioner Cragen that you don't typically use a protective order in your hearings, but instead you simply enforce your rule. Is that correct? Is that the way everybody else handles it? No protective order?
That's typical, but
if the parties ask for one.
Yeah, a taxpayer will, in some of the larger assessed cases especially, will ask for an additional protective order.
Okay. Three, a court enters a protective order. Oh, by the way, the rule, I guess, that that covers that for the Tax Commission would be R-861-1A-37. That's specifically the confidentiality rule. Yes?
Yeah, while you're on that subject, I guess it wasn't as pervasive as I was concerned about, but I have had one county, and it didn't turn out to be an issue because the taxpayer would insist that before they would share information at the hearing with the taxpayer sign a confidentiality agreement. And I don't know if you run into this with assessors or not, but they need to be aware that if the taxpayer doesn't sign it but objects to it, it wouldn't be admitted.
Okay.
But I it turned out I've only seen it in one county. Like I said, the taxpayer said,
So to make sure I understand, if the taxpayer or the appellant refused to sign a confidentiality agreement, then the evidence would not be admitted.
And the taxpayer objected to having the evidence considered.
and that was sustained?
He or she wanted to consider, but didn't want to sign a confidentiality agreement.
Okay.
Then, at least at the hearing that I was at, I would not have admitted it as evidence.
In the case where an assessor wants to present some information but needs a confidentiality agreement in order to present it, and the parties in the hearing refuse to sign it, is there a way?
That's the situation. The
that's
assessor
the one.
Wanted to present the evidence.
So did they want to have a special closed hearing with the other, those who weren't
no,
signing
wanted,
it to step out?
They wanted me to consider the evidence but not share it with the taxpayer.
Yeah.
I didn't want to share it with the taxpayer.
Interesting. Exchanges prior to the hearing should also have a confidentiality agreement, and we've encouraged the assessors when they're dealing with appellants prior to a hearing, anything that's exchanged, they should do so with the signing of an agreement prior to make sure that that's taken care of. Now I have a question to kind of pose. If information is presented in hearing number one and the parties to the hearing obtain that information in that hearing, can they present that information in hearing number two, a separate hearing where that information may be relevant? Especially considering your recent, well, it's, that really wasn't a change, but your rule R-861-1A-12 says that everything is confidential in your hearings and that it may not be disclosed outside the hearing.
Well, what's the question?
So the question is, the parties in a hearing, they obtain some information about maybe some comparable data, and then they go to another hearing, a separate hearing, separate appellant, separate issue, and they have this data that could help that case. Can they present it?
Well, myself, I might think so because of that provision that you shall share commercial information in a hearing, but if it's protected information, then I'm not sure myself.
So, assuming it's confidential commercial information, it's interesting because the statute 59-1-404, paragraph 4, is where it states shall disclose the information, but in your administrative rule, in R-861-1A-37, paragraph 6, it specifically says shall not. So there may be a conflict there. There may not. I mean, maybe it's not a conflict until somebody raises the issue in a hearing, but.
It doesn't subsection 6 of Rule 37 answer your question. It says, except as provided in 6B, commercial information disclosed during an action or proceeding may not be disclosed outside the action or proceeding by any person conducting or participating in the action or proceeding.
So does that administrative rule supersede the statute that require that says shall disclose, if relevant? Because look,
sure.
Right up above on the slide, we've got information obtained from a real estate agent, an appraiser, property manager, another taxpayer. So it could be information obtained from a taxpayer in hearing one, and if it's relevant in hearing two, the statute may say that that shall be disclosed. I mean, that's kind of my question. Like I said, I'm not an attorney, and I think it's something that the great minds in this room could ponder a little bit and maybe give us some direction. But like I said, it may not even be an issue until someone raises it in a hearing.
You know what might be helpful is if you put down the specific site and the statute and the rule and send us an email.
Okay.
Reminding us that there's a potential conflict that might be helpful, if for nothing else, future reference. To remind us that we don't know.
Well, it's a little hard for me to figure out a time when we would get information, confidential information, that didn't come from a real estate agent, an appraiser, a property manager, or another taxpayer, either from the taxpayer directly or from an agent of the taxpayer.
Right.
So all of the information that we get probably comes from one of those sources. So are you suggesting that the statute should be read to say everything we receive in one hearing for taxpayer A can be disclosed in a hearing for taxpayer B, if it's, as long as it's relevant?
That's what I'm wondering. I know that assessors are eager to use some of the information they obtain in hearings. Some of the best evidence they have is evidence they receive during a hearing, and they want to be able to apply that in another hearing.
That's what you're going to answer for us here.
Let's move to the next page. So I'll forward an email with that question on and see what kind of response I can get.
But no, seriously, though, what have you told the assessors? What is the current understanding of that? Because I think that's kind of the current.
As I recall what I said at the last presentation, I just said that there's a question there because the statute says shall disclose, but with this administrative rule, maybe the tax commission has the prerogative to be more detailed in the way they handle their hearings, and so maybe we need to adhere to the rule, but there may be a conflict. I don't know, and I'm hoping to get some clarity and direction on it. So I'm talking to the right people, I hope. So the next slide. I'm sorry.
When we're in doubt, we always give advice on the side of caution to not use it or not disclose it. When in doubt, be careful. So that's the advice we give when in doubt.
Exactly. So to help the assessors understand prior to an appeal and after an appeal and the whole process about exchange of information, because this is probably where you get a lot of your questions again. Is this kind of
Peter
and others? Try to just give them a layout of how things would proceed. First of all, if there's no appeal, then only the taxpayer's own confidential information may be shared with him or her. We're still on commercial information, so. Once an appeal is filed, that's the time when the taxpayer submits their initial information. An exchange typically begins after a hearing is scheduled, although the exchange may begin sooner than it's scheduled, but typically it'll happen after there's a scheduled hearing. And at that point, a confidentiality agreement would be signed. And I just have a note in here about email not being considered confidential, and it's per Rule 861-1A-26, that if somebody desires to send or receive information via email, there's basically a waiver of confidentiality because email is not considered that safe. An email in the administrative rule that I just mentioned, there's a statement. Just read it. So in paragraph 4, talking about representation in A little i3, there's a statement. It says, a request by a party that documents be transmitted by email shall constitute a waiver of confidentiality of any confidential information disclosed in that email. And I'm assuming, I don't know how long ago that was put in the rule, but I'm assuming it's because of the nature of email, it's not secure. However, if there's an encryption process in place, it may be. So.
Just so you know, we've actually amended that rule recently. So the site is now to subparagraph IV.
Okay.
Because we put something new in.
How recently was that?
July.
July, okay.
But that statement is still there?
That statement is still in there. It's interesting that we now have, or we will have tools available to us under Gmail to be able to actually encrypt the stuff we're sending out.
Right. I have a serious issue that I don't know how to deal with then, because we have been sending out and receiving confidential information from the Centrally Assessed Taxpayers for quite some time. And if they knew that they had waived their right to confidentiality by doing that, I'm sure that they wouldn't.
I think the rule is overbroad the way it's written. I think the intention of the rule is that we will send you your own confidential information this way, but we cannot guarantee its confidentiality. So if you ask us to send it this way, we will do it, but you are waiving the possibility of any breach. But I don't think that means, or I don't think it was intended to mean, that you're waiving the confidentiality in other contexts, and that will no longer be treated as confidential information because it was once emailed. I think that probably needs to be rewritten. The other thing is that it's pretty clear that taxpayer A can't waive the confidentiality of taxpayer B. So if taxpayer A, pursuant to these rules, is somehow allowed to see confidential information of taxpayer B because it was obtained in a hearing or something like that, depending on how that issue gets resolved, we still couldn't send taxpayer B's information by email, even though taxpayer A waived the confidentiality, because taxpayer B would also have to waive the confidentiality. Does that make sense?
So in our division, maybe we need to look at it a little bit, but I know there is a process in place. I believe Dolores Furness is involved in that, but there's a system of encrypting some of our records. I think the personal...
When everything gets up on Gmail, it's going to be very easy.
Yeah. So we'll have to kind of revisit that.
But what the rule is supposed to say is that we can't guarantee the confidentiality of it during transit. Not that you waive all confidentiality by asking for it this way.
That makes total sense.
So.
Craig, and then back a couple, before I ask the last question, though, I think I've been given some wrong advice, because I've been telling counties that call, and I know I've given this advice at least a couple of times, that they have to show people the basis of their valuation where when they're in the process of determining whether or not they should appeal. So somebody comes in and says, I want to see how you value my property because I'm worried about the value and I may appeal. And I've told the assessors that they should show them all the data on which they rely to come up with that value, which probably would include confidential information from another taxpayer.
If it's commercial, then I would say, yeah, we need to maybe look at that in more detail. If it's residential, then it's most likely subject to the MLS contract, which allows sharing for hearings, but...
But only after an appeal is filed?
Well, it doesn't state that. It just says in the case of a hearing. And so I think we've talked to them and asked them about it, and they've said, well, if it's prior to a hearing, during a hearing, after a hearing, if it's associated with, and we've kind of maybe assumed a potential hearing or whatever. Yeah, their intent was not to completely tie the hands of the assessors. They just didn't want the information being wholesale distributed to others. So they allow for a certain amount of, they limit it to 10 comps in that exchange. But as far as commercial information, I don't think they're allowed to share comp information from one commercial with the owner of another, because that's, for sure, that is a competitive issue.
Yeah, let me ask you, Denny. So are you telling them that, like, say, if an assessor appraising property A got a lease contract from taxpayer B, you're telling the assessor that they would have to show taxpayer A the lease contract?
What
are you saying they could show? Well, you said they should disclose commercial information.
Yeah, it would be market rents, basically. So rents that were derived from could be a pretty few number of.
But you're not saying show them a specific comparable rent. You're just saying here's the market rent we used to value your property, $9 a square foot. But they may have leases ranging from 8 to 10. You wouldn't show them specific leases.
Correct.
8 to 10.
But I'm still even concerned about showing them that market
on their own property.
Based on what? Yes.
As long as it's not one single component of the market rent that they've developed, which would be, you know, the rent of one particular business, typically they'll use market rent as though it were part of a model. So they've developed it from several other several market rents.
Three people, they derived a market rent. I thought some of the stuff you presented said more information derived from that confidential information from the taxpayer.
Yeah, personally, I wouldn't think that would be considered derived from. Derived from would be.
I guess technically it would. I don't know, but I think if you just had, we've developed a market rent in our models, our valuation models. I'm not sure that would, and you just applied it for the taxpayer's own property. I'm not sure I would.
Yeah, at that point it becomes a generic statistical operation where it's not. That number is not tied to a taxpayer.
Well, it would seem to me that the taxpayer is entitled to some degree of comfort as to how, say, a market rent was derived. And if the tax assessor could tell them, hey, we looked at 5 properties on Main Street in Moab, and A rented for $10 a square foot, and B rented for $12 a square foot, and C rented for $8 a square foot, and D rented for $9 a square foot. They ought to be able to give them that level of information. Not necessarily saying who A, B, C, and D are, and then saying, you know, based on that, we derived a rent of $10 a square foot. They ought to be able to get that level of information, and they ought to be able to get it without filing an appeal. And if they can't, then I think we need to consider amending the statute.
Yeah, that
because
makes,
you know, for an assessor to tell a taxpayer, I've got this black box and I put data in it and it spit out your valuation and I can't really explain to you how I got there, but if you file an appeal, I can give you some more information. That's lousy policy. So if that's where we end up under the statute, we've got to try to fix that.
I think it would be fairly easy just to interpret the existing statute and say, you know, if Betty's bakery wanted to know her own, you know, how it was valued, the problem would be if the assessor said, well, we got this rent from Joe's Donut Shop. That's derived from commercial information, but I don't think what Bruce was describing is compiling, you know, anonymously sourced data. I think it would be pretty easy to say that wasn't derived from commercial information.
If you've only got 2 bakeries in town, and you said, how do you get my rent? And they said, well, we surveyed all of the bakeries in town. You didn't respond, but the information we got was $10 a square foot. That's a little problematic.
Yeah, I've generally interpreted or told, when people have asked, I've told them that derived therefrom means if I have a sale price of $200,000 and I tell them, or I convert it into a dollar per square foot, that would be derived from that particular information. But where a lot of information is put together in a statistical study or modeling, to me that's something entirely different. There's no identity attached to it. So, ready to move on? So the 10-day prior deadline is something the assessors were very interested in, and so in the scenario, that's where the exchange of information ends per tax commission notice. I looked in statute. Of course, it's not in rule or statute, but it is on the notices that you send out under evidence. During a hearing, a Board of Equalization establishes a confidentiality agreement. The Tax Commission enforces Rule 37 and also Rule 12, I guess. And then you're redacting your orders following the hearing as well. Only admissible information is covered by a confidentiality agreement. The rest is covered by grandma. The reason I put that statement in is I had a specific question where, it was the example I already gave earlier, where somebody requested information later on, that although they couldn't request the information based on confidentiality, the confidentiality statute, they could still request it through grandma, and they'd have to fight it out, you know, using that law, I guess. Post-hearing, the confidentiality agreement or protective order should still be in effect until the final disposition. In fact, I guess it might be even past final disposition.
Yeah, I
understand it correctly.
I think maybe you need to change that bullet point.
Because yeah, that may be an incorrect.
That the information would become public once the appeal is over to be exactly what the taxpayer would be trying to prevent.
All right, I'll correct that, make note of that. Now, there's a question during the exchange process prior to a hearing. This is not specifically confidentiality, but it's just procedurally. Assessors have always asked, what if I share information with an appellant, but they refuse to share it with me prior to the deadline, and then they present it at the hearing? And the answers that I've received from Commissioner Cragen and others I've spoken with is that they should object to the information. If the information is over, if the objection is overruled, then they should request additional time after the hearing to be able to respond to that information. Is that the way you'd recommend hearing officers? Should I state that one more time? Or is that a yes?
Yes. I found the assessors are pretty accommodating, much more than taxpayers in my experience, that they'll say, okay, well, we're okay with it if we can respond to it. And I usually don't even get to that level. The assessor would just be, yeah, I'll go and I'll respond in 10 days. But yeah, that's correct, strictly.
And you are all fine with allowing extra time following a hearing to respond to something. Is that right? Okay. So the rest of this information, I could probably speed through a little bit more. It's not as pertinent to you as much as it is the assessors, but we'll try to clip through it. Grandma, the next law, Government Records Access Management Act, found in Title 63G, Chapter 2. Just to give a very vague idea of what is included in the sections, there's more to it than what I have here in the bullet points, but Section 201 discusses the rights of access, basically states that anything is public unless otherwise provided by statute. Section 302 includes information designated as private. That typically includes personal identity information. It may include Social Security number, medical information, that kind of thing. Section 304 typically includes information typically designated as controlled, and that's usually medical, psychiatric, psychological information. That's a stricter confidentiality. Section 305 is what most of us deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's designated as protected. It's generally financial, competitive, educational, employment, and safety information. And the question is, is everything named in here that we have to be concerned with? And no, it's not. Grandma provides some specifics, but oftentimes I think I've seen people arguing general intent with some of the sections of Grandma. And one thing that's not specifically listed is residential sales. Again, we've battled with this. Utah being a non-disclosure state, we always assumed over the years that sales information from residences couldn't be shared. But we have not found a law to back that up. The only law that protects the sale information that we have, which we derive from real property transfer surveys that we mail out, is in section 305, paragraph 14, it covers tax commission audit work papers. So it has nothing to do with the confidentiality of a sale price. It only has to do with that it's a tax commission audit work paper.
So one of my colleagues, you may have known, has been known to expound on the psychiatric and psychological condition of about everyone he knows or has even heard of. Is that person violating Grandma, or is he now, or she yet?
Well, is it possible to designate an entire individual as controlled, or everything coming out of that person's mouth, or?
Well, I haven't seen any self-restraint. So.
The next page or slide gives a few examples of what we have designated here at the Tax Commission for purposes of Grandma. The examples: personal property audits are designated as protected. Property tax appraisal worksheets are exempt because we only do commercial at the Tax Commission, so they're covered by the commercial statute, so that's why they're exempt. Real property transfer surveys and sales ratio study papers are protected, and those are from the paragraph I mentioned earlier, paragraph 14 of section 305. Down at the bottom, assessed value statistical report is public. This is just an example of a grandma request submitted by a taxpayer where the AG's office was asked to provide a response. And so I've got some examples of how they responded. Number one, they requested copies of all communication directly or indirectly related to valuation between the years 2005 and 2012. And the AG's office cited lack of specificity, and there's the statutory citation where they pulled that from. They also requested, the second thing down there, all phone and verbal communication between the Tax Commission and the county, and they wanted it in transcript form. So like above, the example above, they cited lack of specificity, but they also cited the format issue. We're not required to change the format of the data and provided in some other form. The third request was for all sales in the county, residential and commercial, actual versus disclosed between the years 2000 and 2010. And we weren't quite sure what was meant by actual versus disclosed, but I'm assuming disclosed was what was actually provided by the taxpayer. The actual would be maybe what was developed, analyzed, cash equivalency, or after adjustments for non-realty or different things like that. I'm not sure what he was trying to get at, but or she, whoever it was. Specificity was cited. Also, that we don't have to create, compile, or manipulate or tailor the data to get the actual. The commercial statute was cited, and also a privacy statute where under private, there's a statement that says where it's clearly unwarranted, a clearly unwarranted invasion of privacy. And so the AG's office used that as well. Fourth request was for all personal property audits between 2000 and 2010. Again, they cited similar things above. And then they also cited Rule 861-1A-12A, and that's an old rule, so that doesn't match up with the numbering now, but because it was a property tax order, the personal property audits, that those were excluded. Now regarding the MLS license, part two of this contract grants exclusively to the assessor the use of their sale data for their internal business, and it includes models and market reports. And they allow up to 10 comps to be used in appeals. And it doesn't specifically say only during the hearing, but we're assuming it means prior to, and we could even stretch it to an individual taxpayer coming in and discussing their property, which we would consider prior to them filing an appeal. Number six, an interesting note, the contract prohibits the use of these sales for sales chasing. They believe that the use of their data to put a value on one single property compromises the system and equality and fairness, and they believe it would put them in a bad light, and it would cause a competitive commercial problem for them if they were to allow that, so they specifically prohibit that. So you may, in the cases of, in the hearings where the assessors bring in a sale price or the appellant brings in a sale price, assessors may not be willing to simply concede the sale price equals market for one reason, because of this contract. Number six.
I'm sorry, Craig, I didn't hear what you said, WFR.
Wasatch Front Regional Multiple Listing Service. Yeah, sorry about that. Part six establishes that it is confidential information, and they allow it, or court order would require that information to be produced, but the contract provides that we have to allow them 5 days to oppose any court order. And then finally, that their business information is confidential under Grandma. The next slide deals with USPAP, and this is specifically for an appraiser and may not be as applicable in this argument. I probably should just skip over it a little bit, except for one thing I want to point out. Under the recipients, under USPAP, a client can receive its own data, his or her, a client's official representative, or a regulatory or peer review committee. That includes the Division of Real Estate and the Appraisal Board, who receive complaints. If somebody has an appraisal that violates USPAP and they want to complain to the Division of Real Estate, even though USPAP allows them to share the confidential commercial information with the Division of Real Estate, our commercial statute does not permit that. It only permits it within the Tax Commission and the counties. And so sharing it with the Division of Real Estate is not permitted by law, and so that's something that I don't know if we need to have the counties pursue some legislative change on that or not.
I actually went to our AGs on that issue, because our appraisers have to provide representative appraisals when they're getting their license, and they use actual appraisals and actual data and send that to the Division of Real Estate.
Right.
And our AGs said that is not an issue for them to do that, and they could and should continue to send that to
Okay, good. I know the law doesn't specifically say that, but they're interpreting that it's a reasonable action. And maybe this case, Peter's, by the way, is the one that asked the question about sharing with the Division of Real Estate on a complaint. So I would assume the same would apply.
Well, he should ask his own attorney.
He should. Or his favorite ALJ. Okay, so just to quickly, in the depths of USPAP, the ethics rule under confidentiality establishes what they consider confidential. It's information provided by the client that is identified by the client as confidential and is not available from any other source. So verifying independently would solve the problem in a lot of cases for an appraiser that wanted to share information. Secondly, it's information classified as confidential by any applicable law or regulation. So USPAP also acknowledges our statutes and other statutes that regulate confidentiality. And then finally, assignment results, which is ultimately the appraisal answer of any kind. Appraisers are permitted to share it with the client, a person authorized by the client, a regulatory agency, third parties authorized by due process of law, and peer review committees, which is the appraisal board. And there's just an appraisal scenario. And the only thing I want to point out on here is when an assessor receives information from a private fee appraiser, it's the private fee appraiser that is liable through USPAP for sharing that information. And there's nowhere that really provides that they may share that. On this slide, I show that the appraiser may share it with those four people, but the assessor's not on that list unless it's during a hearing. And so the appraiser's not, the appraiser is liable, but the assessor is not. But if the assessor has a relationship and they receive information from a private appraiser, then, and they want to share it in a hearing or some other way, we simply recommend that they get permission from the appraiser or whatever. There was an interesting situation in one of the hearings that I sat in. Appraisers are testifying against each other, and they're always going after each other for USPAP violations, and it's kind of interesting. But in one case, one of the appraisers was an appraisal board member, and because an assessor had made a vague reference to a valuation result from another appraiser outside the hearing, the appraisal board member was trying to get at who was this, because they violated this USPAP statute and made a big deal about it. But I want to ask how do you discount or do you discount information that's provided if somebody indicates that the information violates USPAP? Does that weigh into your decisions, your conclusions about evidence in any way?
Could you be more specific?
Yeah, one party presents an appraisal, a complete full appraisal that seems to be USPAP compliant, but the other party submits an appraisal that is less than USPAP compliant, it's lacking in some way, and they point that out, this appraisal is not USPAP compliant. Do you give it less weight, or do you just take it at face value?
Yeah, it depends myself. If I get an extreme hypothetical,
okay,
USPAP compliant appraisal that had really bad information, and a non-USPAP compliant appraisal that had really good information, I probably give the good information more weight than I would the bad information.
So it's more important to discredit the numbers than it is,
I think so,
the USPAP issue.
I
okay.
So, but everything being equal, to me, a USPAP compliant appraisal of things being equal might add credibility to the, you know, the witness or the report.
Okay.
But you know, there's just a gamut. So it does add credibility, but I think most of us, if not all of us, it comes down to the actual data that we receive.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. The last thing is this table. I've called it a decision chart. After making this presentation, the assessors were still very confused because there are so many laws that overlap, and there's a web of decision making, or of following to make your decision about whether to exchange information. So this is my attempt to try to create a flow chart type situation that's more specific, and I invite you to try it on some scenarios that you know. Let me explain quickly and then give me some feedback on it, because so far this draft has withstood the tests that we've received thus far, but there are still more questions. So the way I've set this up is you start in the left column under information. The kind of information is what's initially there. And just to show you how I've divided this up, I've got the four big commercial items that can be shared with fee appraisers first, sale price, finance, cap rates, income and expense, and then other commercial information and possible examples, the next row. Then on the next page, I have real property transfer surveys, commercial versus residential, multiple listing service sales, data from our ratio link database, other residential sales, property records, work files. Then I've got on the third page, personal property audits and signed statements. And then I've got Board of Equalization orders, State Tax Commission orders, and then personal and private information. And then I've got, I've included public information in the case of somebody requesting everything, that can be rejected. If they want us to transcribe something, we can reject that request. If they want us to analyze something for them, we can reject that request as well. And then on the back page is where I've put appraiser data. So specifically appraisal results, confidential client information, and other information that's legal. So what you would do is start in the left column with the type of information and then go and choose the source of the information and then continue to the right to the accountable party. Who does the law hold liable? And then choose the desired recipient, and then it gives you the answer whether you can share it or not. And the column next to share is there might be conditions involved in sharing it.
Restrictions,
or you can share it under this condition.
Yeah.
And the footnote two simply says there's an exception if you obtain permission from the source. And then whether there's a confidentiality agreement involved. And then the last two columns, the law refers to just the particular category of law, and I've listed what those abbreviations stand for, commercial, state tax commission rules, and so forth on the back under number one. And then the last column, the exact reference of where that is justified or restricted so that they can look it up and get more detail. So once again, I invite you to try this on some of your scenarios. And does anybody have any questions or issues they want to bring up?
I do.
Commissioner Dixon does.
I'm sorry?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you. Well done. Appreciate your time, and I'm sure the assessors appreciated it too. Let me understand, what are you doing to make this public? Is this document or these documents on the website? Can we anticipate them on the property tax website?
I don't know. What do you think? At this point, I think it's a working document. We're trying to understand the law, and it's a tool to help us administer the law as we see it. At some point, I guess, when we stop receiving questions, it might be a good tool to make public.
Well, one item is that it's now been presented in a public meeting, mm-hmm. So therefore, I mean, the document, I think, would be a public document, so I think...
I don't think there's any harm in the public having access to it. I'm just not sure if it would be useful to publish it on our webpage at this point, where it's still in draft form.
Okay. My only thought was that it might be. We just don't know, but I bring that question up. Just along those lines, what do you have on the property tax division website that makes clear to property owners, whether commercial or residential, some of the items that you've addressed in here? Some of my experiences, I don't know about my fellow commissioners or our judges here today, our administrative law judges, is that the assessors live in the world more. I mean, I think county commissioners on a infrequent basis just because of the BOE hearings, but the residential primarily, but the commercial, they don't live in the world. So they come to the tax hearings, Board of Equalization, or hearings before the tax commission, and And there just seemed to be a lot of questions that you just wonder if they couldn't have that information a little more readily available up front. So I'm not trying to be specific about what that information might be. I was just wondering, what do you have on the property tax website that in general is helpful to taxpayers to understand property taxes and how they're done and roles of each party? Do you have anything like that on your website?
There's a lot about that specific issue. There is hardly any about the confidentiality part.
Okay.
There's some pretty good information about, you know, how to appeal, what's expected, time frames, calendars, those sorts of things.
I'm wondering if we should get you to a microphone, but anyway, I don't know that any of that's going to get caught on there, but on our recording.
But related to confidentiality, there's not much, because frankly, we're still trying to develop it. And that's why Craig has started putting this together so that we can understand it better and put something out there. When this is fully developed, we expect to put it on our website as well.
Okay. And I appreciate the difference between the confidential and that. Do you have a requirement? Yeah, I think that would be better too.
Probably give us your name too.
Denny Lytle, Director of Property Tax Division.
I wasn't sure who was going to answer. We've got a microphone up there, but we don't have one here.
I'm 51.
What is your psychological answer?
I'm about 25 pounds overweight, and that makes me feel not good about myself.
You're good enough, you're smart enough, and doggone it, Denny, people like you. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Lytle, after all of that, thank you. I really wanted to understand, because I'm not here trying to put requirements or pressure on the property tax division to do more than you're supposed to do, but is there certain requirements that the property tax division has as far as, I know you have it with assessors and county officials, but the information that you put on your website, is it a courtesy on behalf of taxpayers?
It's courtesy and self-imposed. There's no statutory requirement.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So it's a courtesy that you do to just try to provide information, but there's no requirements.
Correct. We feel a responsibility.
Okay. Great. I appreciate that.
Anything else from me?
Any other questions for Craig?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig. Well done.
This one went much faster than it did with the assessors. They stopped him at every other word. He had to stop and answer a question.
All right. There's nothing else to come before the commission, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
How do we adjourn?
See, aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Yeah.